This is The State of Things. I'm Rusty Jacobs. Coming up, we'll have the story of Princeville, the historic town founded by African Americans after the Civil War. But first, this past Saturday, the North Carolina Democratic Party met to elect a new state chairman. The race came down to two men, Ed Turlington, a Raleigh lawyer who's run national campaigns for John Edwards and Bill Bradley and was Governor Mike Easley's choice for the job, and Fayetteville attorney Jerry Meek, who was the vice chairman of the party. In that role, Meek regularly put 6,000 miles a month on his car, traveling across the state to meet with local Democratic Party organizers. In the end, Jerry Meek got the nod. In many ways, it was a referendum in favor of local, grassroots politics and against high-powered political operatives. Mark Johnson is a reporter with the Charlotte Observer, and he joins us now. Hi, Mark.
Hey, Rusty.
So, Raleigh lawyer, Democratic Party operative Ed Turlington had an impressive list of big-name backers in his bid to run the state Democratic Party, but in the end, 34-year-old attorney Jerry Meek won. So who was it that helped lift Jerry Meek to this victory?
Oh, it was definitely himself. I mean, he's been first vice chairman of the party for the past 2 years, and apparently during that time, he just spent countless hours driving out to any county that asked him to help him put together the basics, to organize precincts, to help put together countywide campaign organizations. And he collected, a lot of chits in that time. And Ed Turlington was kind of recruited into the race in November, by Governor Easley. I think Ed was interested, but I think that Governor Easley helped get him into the race. So he started pretty far behind.
Who, if anybody, does this embarrass? I mean, we're talking about, I think, the state treasurer, Richard Moore, Lieutenant Governor Beverly
yep.
Perdue, Governor Easley, John Edwards. A lot of big-name people were out there saying Ed Turlington should be the pick.
Yeah, I think all of those people fall into the answer of your question, and it's kind of, it's in part a little befuddling because here are North Carolina Democrats who are surrounded. I mean, the rest of the South is going Republican at full speed, and in North Carolina they have held the governor's mansion. I mean, Easley won the state by as big a margin as George Bush did. They've held control of both houses of the legislature and most of the seats on the Council of State, and it's kind of like there are a bunch of people in the party saying, "We keep winning, we can't have that." At the same time, there are apparently some legitimate beefs about a disconnect between county party organizations and the state party organization in Raleigh. I mean, if there were not a legitimate problem there, I don't think you would have seen Ed Turlington emphasizing as strongly as he did how much he focused on the county parties when he was state executive director and when he ran Jim Hunt's campaigns.
What's at the heart of these beefs you're talking about?
I think it's just that the county folks feel like the state party organization is top-down, that they send out their edicts from Raleigh and expect the counties to fall in line, as opposed to, maybe giving them some sense that the counties are providing input and that it's more of a collaborative effort. It strikes me as kind of the standard gripes of any large organization. I mean, the people that run a church or a PTA, folks down in the ranks want to feel like they've got a role. And whether that beef is legitimate or just perceived kind of doesn't matter.
So is there a kind of anti-establishment connection between Jerry Meek's victory and Howard Dean's election as head of the Democratic National Committee?
Well, Jerry Meek certainly thought there was. He pointed to that, and he mentioned, I think it was the chairman's election in, Arkansas, where a young kind of grassroots organized guy won. But, I mean, that was his point. He said the person that was sort of perceived as the insider lost, and the person that was perceived as the outsider and focused on grassroots won. And of course, we see how far that got Howard Dean in the presidential race. I mean, there is something to be said for all the folks that he got excited and invigorated in the campaign, but he ended up getting clobbered.
So what does this mean for Governor Mike Easley, who, again, came out for Ed Turlington in this? Some people have suggested that he could go after a higher office in 2008, namely a pursuit of the presidential nomination or candidacy. So what does this mean for him?
It kind of means a continuation of a not especially warm relationship with the party. And in that sense, it's not much of a change. I mean, Easley has never been the man of the party. I mean, when he ran for governor in 2000, he was kind of the outsider. I mean, the party establishment lined up behind Lieutenant Governor Dennis Wicker. All the big constituency group endorsements went to Wicker. And so Easley got the nomination and basically was able to run as his own man. He didn't, you know, he could say, I don't have to kowtow to these folks. I didn't get their endorsements. So in that sense, it's kind of a continuation as to, you know, his aspirations for higher office. I'll probably be proven completely wrong a few years down the road, but having watched him as much as I have, I would be really surprised to see him run for something beyond governor when this is over.
Because it doesn't suit his
It just doesn't seem to fit his personality.
Right. So what about John Edwards, another big name behind Ed Turlington? Again, you know, a likely candidate in 2008. Does this will this mean anything in the long run for him?
I think less so, because I don't think he was all that heavily involved in pushing Ed for the job. And he also has, I mean, this is a guy who also rose up outside the party organization. I mean, he was a self-funded candidate. I mean, he got the nomination through his money and through his talents as a campaigner. And, you know, he had held no public office prior to running for the Senate. So there's not really a long established relationship there with the party that there was any damage done to.
I want to turn to the State of the State address in just a sec, but one last question on the State Democratic Party, and that is, what does this victory mean for the party? What does it say about the state of the party? What does it mean in the long run? What will Jerry Meek have to do to fulfill whatever you think his mission is?
I guess two things. I mean, one, it says that fratricide within political parties is not limited to Republicans, though they seem to have mastered the art form in recent years in North Carolina. So the Democrats do some fighting amongst themselves. Secondly, it raises some questions about where the party is headed over the next 4 years. I mean, does this mean that more polarizing issues like death penalty moratorium are potentially going to get more attention? I mean, those are issues that people like Easley, who kind of sends out more moderate signals in his administration and his campaigns, would just as soon not have the spotlight focused on those sorts of things. You know, does that mean that there's going to be a shift from that and those sorts of more progressive Democratic members of the party are going to push and put up on the forefront? I don't know the answer to that, but I mean, it raises the question.
Well, what has Jerry Meek said about any of those sensitive issues, like the moratorium?
Yeah, he was asked about it on Saturday, he didn't indicate that, you know, he was going to drive it anywhere. You know, he said he doesn't come in with a particular agenda, but you know, since he's not Easley's guy, there certainly is more room for those types of issues to be at the forefront.
Well, Governor Easley addresses the state tonight with his State of the State address. It's been pretty widely reported for a long time that the state's facing a greater than $1 billion budget shortfall. Do you think we'll hear the governor say anything surprising about what he'd like to see done about it?
No, especially if you read my story on Saturday. I had a story on Saturday basically pointing out that he's going to, in terms of taxes, he's going to let the increase in the sales tax that was passed in 2001 continue, but will propose rolling back a slight increase on income tax for the wealthiest wage earners. I think traditionally what you're going to hear in a State of the State speech is broader themes about where he wants to take the state. He wants to attract more business. He wants to reduce the high school dropout rate. He basically wants to elevate the level of education for people across the board. You know, maybe he'll mention the lottery, don't know. He'll talk probably, you know, a little bit about the general financial direction of the state, but I don't think you're going to hear him getting into the nuts and bolts of it, because he's going to roll out his budget on Wednesday, and I think that's where we'll get down to the bare details.
But he may have some Democrats in the legislature kind of emboldened, A, by this Jerry Meek victory, and emboldened saying maybe pushing for things like cigarette taxes or alcohol tax hikes. I mean, what about those other alternative sources of revenue?
Yeah, and his budget is expected to include a cigarette tax increase, which could go as high as 50 cents per pack. In terms of his relationship with the legislature, again, it's just never been especially warm. It's been perfectly decent. They have their spats periodically, but I don't know that the party election on Saturday is going to embolden anybody more than they already were, just because the relationship just wasn't that thick to begin with.
And just a last quick question, Mark. What will the governor try to accomplish politically with tonight's address?
He wants to. I think, as with President Bush's or any president's State of the Union address, he wants to. He wants to set a direction. He wants to say, here are, these big goals that I want to set. Like I say, the education, kind of raising the bar of where across the board everyone tops out in education in the state, getting high school graduates to go on to community college, getting high school dropouts to finish high school. That is something he pushed on in his first term and really wants to in the second term. And drawing in more business to the state, transitioning the economy from textiles to high tech. I mean, those are a couple of things. He wants to, paint in broad strokes tonight.
Hey, Mark Johnson, thanks so much. Mark Johnson is a reporter with the Charlotte Observer. Support for The State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners who support WUNC. This is The State of Things. I'm Rusty Jacobs. What we're hearing now is the sound of a birthday celebration held last Friday at the St. Luke Church of Christ in Princeville. Residents of Princeville were celebrating the birthday of their town, which was founded 120 years ago this week. Princeville was one of the first towns in the nation established by former African-American slaves after the Civil War. But town residents were celebrating more than history. This month, a special census recount put the population at just over 2,000, the same number of people who lived in Princeville before the devastating floods of Hurricane Floyd left the town in ruins in 1999. Today on The State of Things, we're talking about Princeville, past and present, and we're taking your calls 1-877-962-9862. If you know Princeville, if you've made it through the flood in 99, please do give us a call. We're talking with Rudolph Knight, a historian from nearby Tarboro. Morning, or good afternoon, Rudolph.
Good afternoon.
Describe Princeville for our listeners. People have never been there. Tell us what it looks like. Where's the main center of the town? Is there a main center?
Princeville is a very small village that is across the Tar River Bridge from Tarboro, and it sits between two major highways, 64 and 258, and it's sort of located on swamp land on the southern banks of the Tar River across from Tarboro.
What are the main – you give tours of Princeville. So I'm interested. Where do you take your wards, the people that go on your tours?
Well, our tour includes Tarboro and Princeville, and in Princeville we include Mount Zion Church, the former town hall, which at one time was the public school, also the three cemeteries that are located in Princeville, and we also include Freedom Hill,
which is
where the Union soldiers were camped right after the end of the Civil War, and slaves and people of color that were free congregated to get protection and food and clothing, and that's where Princeville started.
And was there a reading of the Emancipation Proclamation on Freedom Hill?
Is that we believe that there was a reading, an official reading, so that the black people would know that they were free. But we had not ascertained that date. We believe it was somewhere right at the end of the war. It may have been a little earlier, but we think it was read after the Union soldiers camped on the banks of the Tar River.
Right. This area was called Freedom Hill, but not much of a hill, though. Am I right?
Just a small incline. And at that time, it was a few inhabitants in what we know as Princeville today. And these were three families that were free. And it was later named after it was chartered as Freedom Hill.
Now, I'd like to introduce another guest in just a sec, but so the town was kind of founded or started on this place, Freedom Hill, but it's now called Princeville. Just tell us about the two names there.
Well, that was a local name that was given to Freedom Hill, but not the official name. After the town was incorporated in 1865 on its charter, it's referred to as Princeville, and that was to honor Turner Prince, who was one of the early settlers of Princeville.
Right. And now joining us is Joe Miller, who reports on Princeville and neighboring cities for the Rocky Mount Telegram. Thanks for being with us, Joe.
No problem.
Now, you've reported on Princeville's birthday celebrations before. How big an occasion is this 120th for the town?
Well, every year it's a big deal. I mean, I know that last year they got about 60 people, and they always get, you know, big dignitaries. They had Dr. Joseph Lowery, one of the co-founders of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference this year. Last year they had former Representative G. Frank Balance. It's a big opportunity for the town to, you know, reflect on their history and where they're going in the future.
Why might this celebration this year be a little bit bigger, something having to do with new census figures?
Yeah, back before the flood, there was some question about how many people were displaced, and the 2000 census counted approximately 940 residents, and the town officials weren't very happy about that. They thought that it was more around 2100, so they got a grant from the Golden Leaf Foundation of $60,000 to fund a special census, which took place around November of last year. They hired some local residents, and they went around and counted the residents. And they had the room that was where the Board of Commissioners meets basically became the hub of the census. All the numbers were counted there, and they discovered that there were approximately 2,029 residents now. And they were basically saying that because of that, in what they claimed to be an inaccurate census in 2000, they were losing about $300,000 a year in state revenue. So needless to say, they were very pleased when they got these updated numbers.
Because it meant extra money, it meant extra aid.
Yes, absolutely. They hope to be able to hire more police officers as they start discussing the budget process with that extra money.
Right, and just how much would an extra, say, $300,000 mean to a town of Princeville in its budget?
It's a pretty significant chunk. They only have like two police officers right now, and there's about, I believe, six employees for the town. So being able to hire another police officer especially would be extremely important.
Right. Any other projects besides hiring new police officers that the money might go to?
Well, I know they're also working on a African-American museum in the Old Town Hall. Mm-hmm. It's going to have artifacts from Princeville and other things around the area. And also they're working on a park. They got a grant from Lowe's after the flood, and they're creating that. I think it's called a Heritage Park. So they're doing a lot of things right now to try to recuperate after the flood.
Rudolph Knight, a tour guide who lives in Tarboro and takes his tours to Princeville as well. How big an attraction would a museum like this one be?
Would be a great attraction and would probably pull in people that are traveling down I-95.
Joe Miller, how big a plan has it been in the past for, say, Princeville to capitalize on historic attractions?
Well, I mean, that's their whole thing. I mean, the fact that they were the first town chartered by blacks in America, that's a very important part of their legacy, so to speak. So they make it a big point to celebrate that, you know, whenever they can.
Mm-hmm. Now, the town struggled with natural disasters in the past, but they've also struggled with internal political infighting. What can you tell us about that, Joe Miller?
Well, I can tell you that in 2003, they had three different town managers. Back in April, their original town manager, Bobby Hopkins, resigned after the mayor, Priscilla Everett Oates, had accused him of improperly handling some town money. She says that cost the town $81,000, and so he resigned after that. And an audit later cleared him of any wrongdoing. And then in July of that year, they hired Sandra. The next town manager was Sandra Winder, and only 3 months or so after Bobby Hopkins resigned, they voted to eliminate Sandra Winder, and she eventually filed a complaint with the EEOC claiming that they, you know, they discriminated against her because she had a disability. She suffered from chronic depression that violated the Americans with Disabilities Act. So it's just been this long, ongoing thing. And finally, in August of 2003, they hired Sam Knight, and he's been there ever since.
Mm-hmm. What, to your understanding, is the reason or behind all the turmoil?
Well, a lot. It's hard to say entirely, but I mean, basically, this is a board who does have some problems. They don't seem to get along very well all the time. I mean, I can give you an example. Back last year when they were having the budget hearings, Commissioner Carolyn Sharp's daughter was working as an administrative assistant for Princeville, and so the budget was going to eliminate her daughter from the town, and so there was some issues between Mayor Oates and Town Commissioner Ann Howell as to the need for that position. You know, Priscilla Everett Oates was claiming that, you know, the local government commission had seen the budget and suggested that they either eliminate further positions or obviously raise revenue, and she said that it had nothing to do with the fact that, you know, her mother was on the board, and Howell was basically, you know, eventually she ended up voting for the budget 4 weeks later, after the June 30th deadline, but basically she still maintained that Sam Knight could use an administrative assistant.
Let's bring Sam Knight into the conversation now since he's joining us. Sam Knight, town manager of Princeville, welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
And we'll let you contribute to the conversation about the current state of things in Princeville. Just how stabilized have things become?
Well, we are still working on some issues here. One in particular, as you may or may not know, we had to file a petition to get a special census done in the town of Princeville. The last census reported us as having 941 people. We were able to get that census done, and it gave us, now the new count is 2,029. So because of the 941 count, we were losing in the neighborhood of about $300,000 a year coming from Department of Revenue. Mm-hmm. So with this new count, now hopefully around July or August, we will start receiving some of the money that we've been missing, even though they won't go back and make it retroactive, it'll start with the new year. So that is a silver lining, so to speak, on the horizon. And then we are trying to get some businesses and stuff in here, and we are talking to people. Hopefully we get someone to decide to come here now that our count has gone up. So,
Right. There was a time in Princeville's history when it actually, for at least 1 year, I think, had to turn its financial management over to the state. And I think it was the first time that happened in North Carolina. The town's had trouble managing its sewage and water systems. Where do things stand with those services, Sam Knight?
Those services, since the flood, we have been able to upgrade our water and sewage system. Now, we purchase our water from the town of Tarboro. But we've been able to upgrade our water and sewer system with a new pump station, lift station, and so forth. And our water and sewer system now is probably about as well as any you're going to find.
You mentioned Tarboro, Sam Knight, and I want to turn to Rudolph Knight. By the way, no relation there, right? And Rudolph Knight, I want to ask you to talk about Tarboro, which is actually your home. Give us a description. It's just across the river from Princeville. How is it similar or how is it different than Princeville?
Well, of course, it's different. Tarboro was a colonial town that was started in 1760, but it's similar in that East Tarboro, which is the all-black neighborhood, has a connection to Princeville because after the Civil War, when Freedom Hill was started and eventually became Princeville, the majority of African Americans, and I'll say 98% of the African Americans, lived in Princeville, and it was a ideal situation for the city fathers of Tarboro to have a labor force, but on a social level to have them at a comfortable distance. So there's a connection with East Tarboro when it was developed as a black neighborhood. And this came about because of the 1919 flood, which was the most devastating flood prior to 1999's flood. And this is when East Tarboro was developed as a black neighborhood, and that land was previously used as two farming enterprises. One was Panola Plantation, and the other one was Lord Farm. I can go on and on about the differences, but that's it in a nutshell, I believe.
Joe Miller is a reporter who covers these areas. How would you describe the differences or comparisons or contrasts between Princeville and Tarboro?
Well, the main thing, Tarboro is much bigger. It's about, 10,000 people compared to the 2,000 in Princeville. They have a much larger downtown. It's the county seat of Edgecombe County. A little bit maybe more self-reliant, and I think that it's not really fair to compare the two of them entirely because, I mean, Princeville is a much smaller town, a little bit more rural in nature than Tarboro.
Are there major differences demographically, racially between the makeup? So I acknowledging that there's a big size difference.
Not that I'm aware of. I mean, mostly, obviously, Princeville is overwhelmingly African American, and Tarboro will be a little bit more, 50-50.
Mm-hmm. Sam Knight, what are some of the economic issues that Princeville is currently facing?
Well, right now we are working with a smaller size staff than we normally would have. Most of the people I have here on this staff, I actually have six people that are fully assigned here, and then I have a part-time help. And most of my people are working two and three different jobs. And so I'm the town manager, but I'm also the planning and zoning officer and also the director of public works. And my utility clerk also acts as the assistant city clerk and also the assistant finance officer. And then my finance officer acts as the finance officer and the clerk.
Joe Miller, what have you seen? Is Princeville just facing the same kinds of economic symptoms that other communities in Eastern North Carolina are facing, or is Princeville facing its own special or unique economic issues?
Well, a lot of small towns in the Twin Counties, as we call it, Nash and Edgecombe, definitely could use more economic development. Even Rocky Mount, their downtown is even quiet at this time of day. But I think, Princeville, gets more attention than some other places, but really it shares a lot of those issues with other towns around Edgecombe County as well.
Right. And Joe Miller, just a final question for you. I'm just curious, having covered Princeville, what strikes you as particularly special about this place as compared to some of the other places you cover as a reporter?
Well, the fact that it is one of the first towns that blacks charted makes it especially interesting. It's a very religious town, as a lot of towns are in this area. People care very much about their community and their government, possibly more so than in a lot of places, I think.
Joe Miller is a reporter for the Rocky Mount Telegram. Thanks for joining us, Joe.
No problem.
Rudolph Knight, tour guide, I'd like to pick up that with you. First of all, how high is the demand? How many people do you have coming to you looking for tours of Princeville?
Well, it depends on the season during the year. Normally, we have an influx of people that come for the former black high school reunion, so we have a demand for our tours then. And also if we have family reunions, and normally during the warmer weather months is when we have demands for that tour.
Right. We're talking about the historic town of Princeville with Sam Knight, Princeville's town manager, and you just heard Rudolph Knight, a historian who lives in Tarboro. On Friday, our producer Corey Princell traveled to Princeville to ask some residents there a simple question. Why did you come back to Princeville after the flood in 1999? Here are some of the answers.
I left Princeville in 99 for the flood. We lived in Rocky Mount, so we was fortunate enough to come back to Princeville and build a house right here where we got married 53 years ago.
It's just so lovely. I love the town. It's the oldest black town in the nation. Originated 1885, and it's just got a lot of history here. That's why, never thought about leaving. We were just waiting for it to come back. That's what we was waiting for. It's not 100%, but it's 85%. It's back. Everybody's still around. Everybody still love each other. We annoy each other. We're back, basically, yeah.
Some of the people that had to relocate because of the flood is now wanting to come back. So, we got land, and we're building houses from ground up. So they're coming back.
Come back!
Yeah, that's my story.
Princeville is home, and I really know no other place but Princeville. And at the time that I decided to move back to Princeville, it was because I was taking care of my sick father. he wanted to come back home because he felt like Princeville was still his home, and he wanted to be here. He wanted to die here. As long as he was close by home, he felt like he could make it out of the flood. So that's why I decided to stay in Princeville.
And whenever you're down, there's always somebody there, and everybody knows everybody. Everybody around here feels that we're blessed to be in the United States, blessed to be in North Carolina, blessed to be in Edgecombe County, blessed to be in Princeville. So we're just blessed. That's basically it.
Princeville residents talking about coming back to their town after the devastating flood in 1999. We'll hear more about Princeville, the flood, and its comeback coming up. Stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Rusty Jacobs. We're talking this hour about the town of Princeville. Princeville, formerly known as Freedom Hill, was founded on the banks of the Tar River in 1885. It was one of the first towns in the nation founded by African Americans after the Civil War. In 1999, it was devastated by flooding after Hurricane Floyd. Today, we're talking about Princeville's past and future. We're joined by Sam Knight, town manager, and Rudolph Knight, local tour guide, and we're taking your calls at 1-877-962-9862. Sam Knight, the night the waters of the Tar River began rising, a lot of residents pitched in to help sandbag the dike. Tell us about that night.
We had received a call from our mayor that she had spoken with the people who were handling our water situation over here in Viral Lake, and they had informed her that we needed to have some sandbags filled up to start stacking them along the dike. And so the call went out, the firemen and the policemen went out and gathered people from the local club and in the community, and we had about 200 people out there filling sandbags. And that was about 8:30 at night, and it lasted until about 1:30 early the next morning, at which time we realized that the more sandbags we filled up, the water was still coming up over them, so we decided that it was time to evacuate.
Where were you that night?
I was out down at the local truck stop, which is in Princeville, supplying gas and stuff for our emergency vehicle, food, keeping food out there to some of the citizens and so forth as well.
What do you remember about what you heard from people coming through the truck stop?
That the water was coming up faster than they had ever seen any water coming before. And then the next day, we was evacuated from the truck stop because we had gotten cut off from the rest of the town. And when we got to the center, people was telling us about their experience, how some of them had to be evacuated by helicopter, just as I was, and how boats had to pick up some, and some was on top of their rooftop waiting for boats to come through to pick them up and so forth. So it was some very interesting stories.
Rudolph Knight, where were you when Hurricane Floyd hit the area?
Well, I had left my house on East Wilson Street to go and spend the night with my mother on West Wilson Street. So I was at her house. And the next morning, that was right after the flood. It was very little. But on that Thursday night, we received a call that the water was rising in East Tarboro. So that Friday morning, she and I went to just look at the water. And it had come up on the east side of East Tarboro and had covered the projects. I had gone on St. David Street, and it had come up the hill by the St. Paul Amazon Church, and I had never seen the water come up, climb that hill on the lower end of St. David. So I knew we were in trouble. And I would like to point out that East Tarboro is surrounded by three sides of the river because it flows from the north over to the east and then around to the south. So East Tarboro was just as devastated as Princeville was in that sense.
Right. Michael on the line from Raleigh is calling. He's got a question about flooding in the area. Hi, Michael.
Hey.
What's up?
I was wanting to know, has Princeville done anything to repair the earth dike to prevent a flood again?
Yeah, good question. Sam Knight?
Yes, the dike has been completely repaired. As a matter of fact, previously the dike was made out of sand, and that was one of the problems that we found out from this flood. As the water came over the dike, it carried the sand with it, and it held the water in Princeville for 10 days because the floodgates that are down at the bottom of the dike was closed up by the sand. So what we did this go-round, some of us flew out to North Dakota and South Dakota and looked at how the dams and dikes were out there. And this time it was done with clay. And as you know, once clay get hard, then water comes up there. It don't carry the clay with it as the sand did. So that makes it even better. And now we have a study being done with money from the federal government and the state government to determine what, if anything else, can be done to make sure this don't happen again.
Well, Sam Knight, the dike that failed to hold back the floodwaters in 1999 had been built to a height that was established by the 1919 flood, which had been the biggest up until then. Was this new dike built to the 1999 flood level?
Right.
Okay, so
it's built to the same level, 36 feet high.
All right, so that this new mark was established by the 1999 flood, and that dike,
right.
the current dike represents. Michael, thanks a lot for that call. Rudolph Knight, Princeville's had regular floods since the 1700s, so the flood of 1999 was no exception. Were there other floods, other as devastating as this one?
Yes, they have. As I mentioned earlier, the 1919 flood was the most devastating flood before the 1999 flood. But every year, Princeville had floods in the spring and sometimes in the fall of the year. And ever since, there have been a recording of anything of historical nature in Edgecombe County. It goes back to when George Washington did his southern tour, and there's a written account of when he left out of Tarboro and it was flooded, and he was going to Pitt County, and that slaves rowed him over on a boat to a safe point on the shore, and that's the earliest written account that we have.
Right. Many instances of floods, Sam Knight, it raises the question, why relocate? Why keep rebuilding flood after flood after flood? Go ahead.
Now, there were many floods that happened in the town of Princeville up to 1965, up to the building of the dike. Once the dike had been built, there has not been any major flood over here until 1999.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 1999... But when the dike was built in 1965, there was a sense that we would not have any more flood. But as you know, with the amount of water that we got from the two storms that came through here, Hurricane Dennis and Hurricane Floyd, then we got in excess of 21 inches of rain during that period of time.
So is there a sense of among town officials that this new the newest dike or the newer dike will actually keep the town from ever getting devastated like this again?
Not ever, because we don't know what the will of the Almighty may be. We are convinced that unless we have another flood with the amount of water that we got in 1999, the dike would do its job.
Rudolph Knight, I'm noticing you just laughing knowingly. What do you think?
I'm in much agreement with him. You can't predict that. There are a lot of other factors that have to come into play. Also, I understand that at one time that Princeville was considered on the floodplain, but now it's considered as on the riverbed. And water has always been a issue with the survival there. And it's located on swamp land, which is lowland. And we classify that now as the wetland. So we hope that the flood, and because with all scientific and technology reports, that we feel like that it will it will protect the town. And we hope that it will protect the town.
Sam Knight, in 1999, a railroad crossing cut into the dike was an area of vulnerability to flooding. Does the new dike have a rail crossing cut into it?
It have a rail crossing cut in there, but if the water raised, if the difference between the dike and the rail crossing, and also since the dike had been built, they also did Highway 64 going east and west. And that cut into the dike, and that was never repaired to keep water from coming in. Those areas have been taken care of, and once the water gets to a certain level that our emergency management team feel is at a certain height, they are authorized then to notify the railroads that they will have to stop the trains from coming through there, and they will block it up. We have a metal container that we put there to block it up to make it bring up to the same height as the dike.
Right. On the line now, we have Sequita Mungo, who's related to a resident of Princeville. Sequita?
Yes.
Hi. Thanks for joining us.
Hello.
What was it? You were in Princeville when the 1999 flood hit?
Yes.
What was it like when the river rose?
It was kind of, well, I wasn't afraid because I was going to school. It was like, I think the day before the hurricane. And I was saying the river is going to rise, but I wasn't sure that it was going to flood. But it wasn't scary. It was just the point we just had to get out.
Where did you actually, was your body getting covered by water?
I mean, no, we wasn't getting covered by water. Actually, we got out before the flood, it really overflowed.
Mm-hmm. What kind of things do you remember seeing after the flood hit?
Well, I walked downtown, and like you couldn't go over the bridge, but most you could see like the water level like in certain parts of the town, like in the east part of Tarboro, water level.
Mm-hmm. How do you think Princeville has changed because of the flood?
Well, I think that Princeville has changed where it's kind of better.
How so?
I feel comfortable that the older people, I'm glad that the older people are much happier, and I also attend a church in Princeville, and it's kind of better.
Sam Knight, I was wondering what you think, what lasting impact you think the flood left on your town?
One of the impact that the flood has brought into reality is the fact that that dike, as high as it is, there's no guarantee that water won't come over it one day, and we know that. I think when the dike was built in 1965, everybody had a false sense of hope that they would never have to worry about being flooded again. And so a lot of those entities that you normally have in place, like your emergency management teams and having volunteers set aside to do certain things, were kind of left along the path. Now, though, we have an active emergency management team together that's headed by our fire chief and chief of police. We have about 60 volunteers that names are on a list that are ready to be mobilized at a moment notice to assist us with evacuation and so forth. We are in the process of getting ready to install, hopefully, a system that will help us to alert rather than having to send the fire department and the police department out with the sirens, have a system that will alert the people when we feel that we need to evacuate, and that way we can spend more time with using those vehicles as evacuation tools. That's one of the things. The other thing is that it made the people realize that prior to the flood, nobody hardly knew anything about Princeville. And it kind of, after the flood, it made the people realize that if you live in a shell so that information not getting out about you, then guess what? Nothing comes in to you as well. So now we have really been identified throughout the country as to the historical aspect of the town, plus the fact we've made a lot of friends at the federal, state, private level that is constantly trying to help us over here in Princeville.
Sequita Mungo, we thanks for joining us. Just last question, do you hear from people who were once lived in Princeville but were too scared to go back because of possible floods in the future?
Yes, I mean, nothing's wrong with Princeville. It's a well town, and like it's in Princeville, people, they all want to help each other, no matter what.
Sequita Mungo, thanks for joining us today. So Rudolph Knight, Sequita Mungo mentioned this spirit of camaraderie in the town and a real kinship, I guess, because of the shared experience of going through experiences like floods. Is that something you see a lot on your tours of the area?
Oh, yes, very, very, very much so. as I said, that there's a connection between East Tarbor and Princeville, so you have this unity, and you have people that are willing to share and to help. I would like to add something about the attention that Princeville has received, and that has really put them in line with other tourism plans for the whole region, and that there will be an African-American presence, which it should be a presence for Princeville.
Sam Knight, we've talked a lot about the natural disasters that the town's faced, and we've mentioned before some of the internal political strife that has undermined the town over the years. Which is the bigger threat to Princeville's continuing existence?
Well, both of them can be classified as a big threat, but you have to also understand that we are a government like any other municipality, and I don't think you're going to be able to walk into any government and find that everybody always agree on everything. And that's one of the problems that we have. However, we do agree to disagree. And it don't always work out the way that maybe I want or maybe certain other people want, but in a democracy, the majority wins. So when the majority wins, then you have to go that route.
Rudolph Knight, what about what's key to the continued survival of Princeville?
I think the key survival is what Sam Knight is exemplifying, and that's open communication, and that you follow the democratic rule that if the majority votes for a certain thing or they're in favor of it, then you follow those dictates.
And I'd like to ask you again, this town is battered, time after time. Why is it essential, in your estimation, that Princeville continues to be, a presence on the map of North Carolina?
It's very essential because of African-American history, because of the exclusion in most of the documents, that this is a tangible, it can be touched, it can be seen, and the things that represent African-American life since colonial times, and it can be visited. And as I said, these are tangibles.
And Sam Knight, what do you say to listeners to convince them to come take a Rudolph Knight's tour of Princeville?
I tell them that Princeville and Tarboro are side by side. There's a lot to be seen in both locations. We are, for the first time, trying to capitalize on our historical aspect, and we are hoping to get all that in line. But if you come down to Princeville, there's several things you're going to see, but most importantly, you're going to run into a group of people who welcome you open-armed to our town. And not only that, but you get a chance to talk to some of the people who can tell you some of the history dating back as far as 1865, when their ancestors first came over here to find this part of the area.
Sam Knight, Princeville Town Manager, thanks so much for joining us today.
You're very welcome. Glad to be here.
All right. And Rudolph Knight, a historian in Tarboro. Thank you, Rudolph.
Thank you for having me.
That is the state of things for today, and thanks very much for listening. If you have a comment about our show, drop us an email here at sot@wunc.org. Support for the state of things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I'm Rusty Jacobs.